Chapter 23. On its approach to Orizon, Travertine directed the full bore of its mapping sensors at the little world's surface. The instruments clarified a picture of a virtually airless planet. Its grey-pink surface, lavishly cratered, its magnetosphere extinguished, its atmosphere no more than a thin, attenuated relic, slowly leaking into space. Nothing orbited Orizon. No moons or stations or ships, and the planet showed no obvious signs of large-scale settlement. There are a handful of metallic features scattered within several hundred kilometers of each other, but few of them were large enough to be independent camps. Somewhere in the middle of these scattered signatures was a larger, concentrated cluster of objects and power sources, and this coincided with the origin of the most recent burst of transmissions. They studied it at maximum magnification, picking out a small hamlet of domes and locks and connecting tubes, with hints of deeper structures buried underground. Even from orbit, it had a makeshift, unplanned look to it, as if thrown together in haste, using whatever components were available. Scratchy trails led away from the camp, aimed in the rough direction of the other metallic features, far over the camp's horizon. A surface expedition was soon made ready, and a scouting party selected to go down in the heavy lander. Vazin would lead it, accompanied by Goma, Loring, Karian, and Dr. Namejo.
"And Ru," Goma said.
"She isn't well enough," Vazin said. "I watched her stumbling around only a few hours ago."
"We are all stumbling around, Gandhari. Ru's no worse than the rest of us, anyway. Why the hell does Maslin Karian get to come along if Ru can't?"
"He has every right."
Goma folded her arms.
"So does Ru."
"It took a lot of negotiation to talk Maslin into coming on his own, rather than as part of a larger Chancer delegation. But if it means this much to you, I will speak to Satanin again."
"Do so."
"I am not accustomed to taking instructions, Goma."
"I mean, please."
"You are very determined," Vazin said, not without approval. "There is more of her in you than any of us realize, I think. But be careful you don't become her. I rather like you the way you are."
Namejo was initially unwilling, declaring Ru still much too frail for a surface expedition. But at the collective insistence of both Goma, Ru, and, with a measure of reluctance, the captain herself, he eventually agreed to reconsider his position. While the lander was being readied, he brought Ru back to the medical suite for another series of tests. Whether it was stubbornness or some late improvement in her condition, Ru scraped narrowly through. Namejo conceded that she could cope with the spacesuit's breathing system, and she was not so weak that the trip in the lander would cause her difficulties. In return for this concession, Goma agreed not to cause a fuss about the presence of Maslin Karian.
"Whatever persuasion you used on Dr. Namejo," Goma said later, when she and Ru were alone in their room. "Tell me, you're really well enough for this?"
"I am."
"Good. Because I need you around for the rest of this expedition. And don't forget, we have a return trip to make."
"Yes," said Ru, feigning surprise. "Somehow that had slipped my memory."
"I mean, you have to be strong for that too. No good wearing yourself out here."
"I know you mean well, but honestly, nothing could stop me being on that lander. Miss the chance to see you get taken down a peg or two by your dear dead grandmother or whatever she is."
"Glad to hear your motives are so pure.
Scientific curiosity comes into it too, of course. Tell me you're as excited by that as I am."
Despite her apprehension, Goma forced a smile.
"I am."
It was true. Or near enough. For the first time since Mposi's death, she had something else to think about. The prospect of having a few of their questions answered, albeit at the expense of dealing with the haughty reincarnation of her distant ancestor, could not help but excite her. She was desperate to know more, and soon she would. But still, Mposi.
"Ru, there's something I need to tell you. I wasn't happy bringing it up until you were stronger, but..."
If you're breaking up with me, your timing is a little unfortunate. Please don't joke.
All right, sorry, go on.
Do you remember me asking you to try to reprogram my bangle?
I couldn't.
No, but Ayana Loring could. We fixed it, and I broke into Graves' room, where they were keeping him after the trial, before they put him into freeze. It was late one night, no one else around. I wanted to see him, to speak to him before skipover.
In the name of hell, why?
Doubts. Mposi. Him being a better judge of people than most of us will ever be. I wondered, worried.
Gomer hesitated, realizing she was on the threshold of confessing something that could not easily be undone.
I wondered if Graf was telling the truth, that he didn't kill Mposi and they were acting together after all.
Oh, he really got to you, didn't he?
I had to be sure, Rue.
You mean you had to let that little weasel plant the seed of doubt in your mind? I thought you were stronger than that wife. I thought you had sense.
Goma did not rise to the provocation. She was prepared to give Rue the benefit of many doubts, given the drugs currently swirling through her blood.
No one got to me, and Graves' story isn't ridiculous. Even Captain Vazin couldn't establish his guilt beyond all doubt, which is why she accepted this half-measure of having him frozen rather than executing him. Someone did try to damage the ship, no doubt about that. But if it wasn't Grave, then the culprit is still out there.
Well, let's see. Grave was a second chancer, and there are 11 other second chancers on the ship. Where do we start? With the women or the children?
Please take me seriously.
Rue nodded firmly.
I am. But equally, I have no idea how we're meant to act on this change of heart of yours. Nothing you've just told me will cut any ice with Gandari.
Have you spoken to her about it?
I can't see what it'd achieve. She said Grave side of things. I've nothing to add to that.
Then what exactly was it about this midnight visit that rocked your world to its foundations?
He mentioned Tantos.
Rue made a sneer of disgust.
And if there was one emotional button he knew would work on you.
It wasn't just that,
Goma said, trying hard not to snap.
He's aware of the possibility that splinters of the original population might be out there. He doesn't even hate what they are, but he says whoever's behind the sabotage attempt won't sit back if we encounter them.
Won't sit back? What does that even mean?
That the saboteur has another weapon, but won't use it until we're close to them.
If we ever meet them.
Goma nodded solemnly.
If.
Then we'd both better hope Grave was delusional, hadn't we?
Or keep our wits about us. I keep thinking Uncle Mposi would have had all the answers, all the wisdom. But I bet he'd have given anything for Chiku's guidance, and Chiku probably felt the same way about Sunday.
And Sunday would have missed whoever, all the way back to your mouldering ancestor.
Hard to think of that sour old relic missing anyone, but I suppose she must have.
One day, Goma, it'll be you that someone misses.
I am not so sure about that.
I am, Rue said.
The lander had a crew capacity of 12, so there was more than enough room for 6 of them, including spacesuits and surface equipment. Goma had seen the heavy transport being prepared for departure. It was a squat, multi-engine cylinder with retractable landing legs and an angular cockpit bubble jutting out from the cylinder's side, its faceted windows offering the best possible field of view for the pilot. Inside there was a surprising amount of space, with a bridge, commons area, medical suite, galley, and several semi-private crew compartments, each of which was rigged with zero-gravity sleeping hammocks. Vazin was already in the command chair on the bridge when Goma boarded, the chair projecting out into the bubble. Vazin imprisoned by folding screens and controls. She appeared to be in her element, utterly indifferent to the risks presented by this expedition. If the worst befell her, though,
Nassim Kaspari had the necessary skills to command travertine. After a series of checks and reports, they were finally given permission to detach from the larger ship. They pushed out to a safe distance, then executed a de-orbit burn. The lander descended under controlled power, shrugging aside the atmosphere's ghostly resistance. They were never quite weightless, and as they lowered closer to Orizon, so the pull of its gravity became steadily more apparent until it reached a maximum of about half a G. They overflew the encampment, first at an altitude of 10 kilometers, then at successively lower elevations, while Vazin picked out a suitable landing site. It was near one of the scratchy trails that led out to the more distant features. The terrain was uneven, with escarpments and slab-sided plateaus. On some of the lower outcroppings, Goma noticed dome-shaped piles of rock, arranged too deliberately to be accidental.
"I meant to speak to you before this," Maslin Karayan said, sitting close enough that she could not ignore him.
"Did you?"
"Yes, but the time was never right. I wanted to say that I am truly sorry for what happened to Mpozi."
They had made the bullish barrel-chested man trim his beard in readiness for skipover. All of them had also had their scalp hair cut short or shaved off completely, so that the requisite transcranial scans could be conducted with minimum difficulty. In Karayan's case, the change was the most dramatic, softening his features and making him look both younger and less sternly patrician. Goma saw this as a trap, not a blessing.
"And I am sorry that extremists were ever allowed on this expedition."
"In your view, then," Karayan said, "anyone who does not share your exact philosophy is an extremist?"
"If you want to put it like that."
Karayan ruminated. She thought she had silenced him, but after a moment he said,
"Mpozi would not have agreed with you."
"You think you knew him that well?"
"Well enough. Our paths crossed over the years, and I always found him willing to set aside differences, to see beyond ideology."
"Ideology is all there is."
"Really? I would have thought there were many other human qualities worth considering: fairness, generosity, a sense of humor, a willingness to see the best in people, even those we do not automatically agree with."
He glanced out of the window at the monotonous and arid terrain over which they were now circling.
"Shall I tell you a story?"
"If you must."
A whir signaled the deployment of the landing gear. It whined into place and locked with a series of metallic thuds.
"I was gravely ill once. A bad reaction to one of the local organisms on Crucible. Mpozi and I were political adversaries, but he still found time to arrange help for my wife and children, and to come and see me when I was well enough for visitors. He did a great deal for me and mine, although he always downplayed it, said it was a small favor, nothing more. I never forgot that gesture, and I always made sure Mpozi knew it."
"You fought like cats."
"We argued our positions when much was at stake, but nothing interfered with our basic respect for each other as human beings. And I regret very much that we have lost Mpozi's stabilizing influence. He was an ally to us all."
She could have left it at that, but something in his manner had undermined her instinctive dislike of him. She thought back to a conversation with Mpozi, when he mentioned the small favor. It accorded with Karayan's account of the same kindness.
"Did you really not know Peter Grave before the expedition?" "I wish I had known him better. Unfortunately, there was very little contact between us until shortly before the ship left. Perhaps if there had been more time..."
At the risk of putting words into his mouth, she said,
"You'd have realized what he was capable of." "I am tempted to think so, but in practice, I'm not sure I am that good a judge of character. During his time with us, I certainly sensed he was an outsider, or rather an outlier. Call him an extremist, if you will."
"Then why did you put up with him?"
"Our movement encompasses a spectrum of viewpoints, I could hardly criticize Peter Grave for believing in certain things more forcefully than some of the rest of us.
He was speaking in a low voice now, barely audible above the dull roar of the lander's motors and life support system. Again, Goma recalled Mpozi telling her that Karayan was obliged to project a blustering self-image in order to unite the disparate groups of second chances. Here now, perhaps he felt able to express more moderate sentiments.
"Of course, we always agreed on the essentials," he said, as if that affirmation were necessary.
"Of course," Goma said. But they were playing a game now, each understanding what the other really meant.
"Be glad that Peter Grave is where he is," Karayan said. "There may have been one bad apple among us, but I do not think there will be a second."
She nodded, wishing desperately to believe things were as simple as that. Grave the conspirator, Grave the murderer, and Grave now safely on ice for the rest of the expedition. They were on final vertical descent now, the blast of the lander's motors beginning to pick up dust and small pieces of surface debris, sending them scurrying away in surging concentric waves. They were not far from the encampment. Goma could easily make out the silver crest of the nearest dome. Vazin called out altitudes. 100 meters, 50, then down in increments of 10. The salmon-colored dust rose and swallowed the view. Finally, Goma felt the soft compression of the landing gear touch down and heard the motors stop. The lander rocked slightly, then was still.
"Engines off, stable and secured for return to orbit," Vazin declared, not without a measure of pride.
It did not take long to prepare for the surface. All six of them exited through the lander's high-capacity lock and then climbed one at a time down the ladder, which had deployed upon touchdown. They wore lightweight spacesuits, silver-white to begin with, but which selected their own visually distinct color coding as soon as the party assembled below the lander. Goma had received just enough training not to feel encumbered by the suit.
"Are you all right?"
she asked Rue, concerned that her breathing sounded labored.
"Stop fretting," Rue said,
in a firm but friendly tone. They moved away from the lander and joined the trail heading back to the encampment. They had touched down in an area of low, gentle hills, reaching away under a mauve sky that darkened to purple-black at its zenith. There were a few clouds, laddered wisps of high-altitude vapor, and enough of a breeze to stir dust around their feet, but the air was 1,000 times thinner than the atmosphere aboard their ship. They could see stars and other worlds in this solar system. The trail had been cleared of debris, but a treacherous scree of small stones and pebbles littered the surrounding terrain. The colors of this planet were all mauves and fawns and shades of pale rust. It was relentless and depressing, not a hint of a living organism anywhere to be seen. The encampment looked further away now they were down. Surrounding it, but thinning out with distance, was a junkyard of failed or abandoned technologies. There were transmitter aerials, sagging where their guy lines had snapped. There were radio dishes, jammed into the dirt, and now half filled with dust. There were boxes of electronics, gutted and exposed to the elements. Where electrical or data cables were still strung from pole to pole, they had been hung with tattered, fluttering pieces of metal foil, like bunting. A drum fixed to an axle, like a wheel, appeared to turn lazily of its own volition. Nearer the camp, the air of decrepitude lessened. Projecting above the small cluster of domes was a skeletal tower surmounted by a set of transmitters and receivers of differing function. Though it had clearly been repaired and patched up over the years, it still looked operable, with various steerable dishes and antennas, plus the tubes of what Goma guessed to be optical telescopes or ranging devices. Of a spaceship, even a short-range vehicle, even something to cross the ground, no trace existed. They halted as one, noticing movement. To one side of the camp was a low cliff, perhaps 3 or 4 stories high. The cliff face was nearly sheer, but a figure was nonetheless clinging about halfway up it, with spider-like tenacity. Feet planted on the narrowest of ledges, one hand grasping a rocky protrusion, the other wielding a cutting tool. All along the face, to both sides of where the figure worked, was a dense patterning of angular inscriptions. The cutting tool had a sun-bright tip, a glaring flicker. Where it touched the cliff, the rock breezed off in a constant curling ribbon of grey dust.
"It's her," Goma said.
They had made no sound in the near vacuum of Orizon, but the figure nonetheless turned off the cutting tool and slipped it back into a pouch on a utility belt. With disarming speed, and an equally disarming lack of concern for their own safety, the figure appeared to descend the crag in a series of perilous backward hops. On reaching the ground, the figure looked back up at the cliff, as if inspecting the day's work, then turned to address the landing party. The figure was small and slight in stature, clad in an older, clumsier model of spacesuit than those worn by the landing party. The figure raised a hand. For a moment, nothing was said. The figure and the landing party facing each other in silence, nothing moving except the dust and the flapping flags and the idly turning wheel.
"Eunice Akinya?" asked Vazin.
A voice buzzed across their communications channel. It was a woman's, speaking Swahili, with a curiously old-fashioned, fussy diction.
"No, Laika, the space dog. Who else were you expecting?"